The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening.
Good evening.
How are you?
Wonderful.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. I'm Dr. Barbara Collins, CEO of Positive Trends, Inc., and I'm thrilled to welcome you to tonight's author event and discussion. My daughter, you may have met her, Monique Moore Pryor, Executive Director of the Free Library of Philadelphia Foundation. I was thrilled and excited when my daughter asked me last week, unexpectedly, "Mom, do you want to introduce Billy Dee Williams?" I said, "What?" I was so excited. It was just amazing. I think I scared my son-in-law, Eric. Mr. Billy Dee Williams, it's an honor to introduce him. His movies soothe my soul with joy and pride, watching him be one of the few black actors in the movies. I remember connecting with my girlfriends, remembering scenes from his movies, like Lady Sings the Blues. We can name them all, can't we, ladies? I really don't remember how many times I've seen Lady Sings the Blues. I know, everybody, you have listened to women saying this line in Mahogany. If you know it, say it with me. Let me tell you something, and don't you ever forget it, that success is nothing. Say it without someone, come on, you love to share it with. Yes. I asked Mr. Williams if I had permission to quote him. He's seen that quote so many times. I read it to him. He said, "Yeah, you got it right." Now, oh, my heart is beating. It is my pleasure to introduce our guest to the stage. While Billy Dee Williams is known to many as Lando, how do I say it? Calrissian? In the Star Wars movies, The Empire Strikes Back, Return of the Jedi, and The Rise of Skywalker. His storied career includes a myriad of appearances in film, television, and on Broadway since the 1950s. Honored with NAACP Image Awards, induction into the Black Filmmakers Hall of Fame, recognition from the African American Film Critics Association, and a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. Billy Dee's achievement in his industry has been nothing short of stellar. In addition to his work in entertainment, I didn't know this, Billy Dee is a celebrated painter, musician, and now author. Gifted with an ability to bring other stories to life, tonight he is here to share his book, What Have We Here? Portraits of a Life. Brings us along his journey from childhood in the 1930s in Harlem, through his illustrious career as he triumphed over Hollywood racism and typecasting. Joining Williams on stage, award-winning journalist and broadcaster Tracy Matisak. We are so pleased to have them with us this evening. Please join me in welcoming Tracy Matisak and Billy Dee Williams to the Free Library. Yes.
You know, if I didn't know better, I would say they almost like you out there. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for being with us here tonight at the Free Library of Philadelphia. We are just thrilled to have Billy Dee Williams with us. I know when I mentioned to my brother that I was doing this interview, he said, Trey, if Mom had lived, she would have arm wrestled you for the opportunity to sit and talk with Billy Dee Williams. So welcome, Billy Dee Williams, to the Free Library of Philadelphia.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
And congratulations on the book, which is called What Have We Here? Now, many of your fans will recognize that line, but tell us the significance of the title of the book.
What have we here? Well, actually, it was a piece of dialogue from The Empire Strikes Back when I meet Princess Leia.
Yeah.
But I think of it two ways. It's romance in one sense, but in another sense, it's looking at my life as a walking absurdity that I...
and
it's sort of a comment on, a whimsical comment on my life and what I've involved myself in for all of these years.
Well, you know, you write in the book...
A lot of silliness.
Well, you write in the book that playing that role of Lando Calrissian in Star Wars was really a role that you felt like you were born to play. Beyond what it did for your career, what was it about that role that was so satisfying for you?
Well, you know, when I heard the name Calrissian, I said, that's an Armenian name. And I said, oh, let me see what I can do with this. And then, of course, when I got the cape, that kind of put it all together. That was Errol Flynn time. So I really wanted to make the character into a, you know, he was a heroic figure, but a dubious heroic figure. But I wanted to make him bigger than life.
Yeah. So that movie, of course, was an enormous success. It made a lot of money, grossed hundreds of millions of dollars. But for you and for your character, Lando, there was a price to pay for that success, because at the end of that, the one that you were in, that first one that you were in, there's sort of this cliffhanger, and it looks as if you've sold out your friend. Can you talk about what happened after that movie came out? How did people react to that when they met you?
Well, first of all, I got a piece of the action, so. and being the capitalist that I am, that was all I needed to know. But anyway, if you're talking about the whole situation between Lando and Darth Vader and...
yeah, like how people, after the movie came out, and, you know, how did people react? Because they thought that you had sold your friend up the river at the end, because it was kind of a cliffhanger. And you're right about how people reacted to you.
Well, the whole situation, I mean, people take all of these movies too seriously. But... everybody accused me of betraying Han Solo. Even when I picked my daughter up from school, the kids would run up to me and, you betrayed Han. I mean, the airline stewardesses would accuse me of betraying Han Solo. And I even had a 10-year-old kid threaten me. I had a Q&A one day, and this kid... He looks at me. He sat. He was in front of a microphone, and he said to me, "You ever betray anybody?" Scare the hell out of me. I said, "No." And he said, "No. You tell me. You can tell me. we can go." And his father is standing behind him, just getting a big kick out of it. I wanted to punch the father in the face. but he says, "No, we can go backstage, you know, and you can tell me if you've betrayed anybody." But anyway, I've had situations like that. But eventually, I think what people didn't realize is that Lando was up against Darth Vader and Boba Fett. Yeah. Look at that. I'm sitting here explaining this. Ridiculous. You know, and I was going to, you know, I always, I, it's not I, it's Lando. You know, he's about to lose his situation, you know, because of Darth Vader. Mm-hmm. And he was trying to, you know, he was trying to hold on to it. I mean, I had all of that dialogue, which really explained the whole thing.
Right.
And everybody completely overlooked that dialogue. But anyway, I finally had to say to everybody, folks, did anybody die? Nobody died. You know, so anyway.
Yeah, yeah. It's a rough time. prior to Star Wars, of course, you starred in Lady Sings the Blues with Diana Ross. You played Lewis McKay, her third husband. You also played the activist Brian Walker in Mahogany, also with Diana Ross. Remember those? Both of those movies were big successes. And yet, after the success of each of those movies, you went through, as you describe it in the book, kind of a rough time. You had frustration about the kinds of roles that were coming up for you after those movies. In fact, you write about being at the top with nowhere to go. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about...
I said all of that?
You did say that. It's right here in the book.
Wow.
But you talked about the general lack of meaningful roles for black actors. And I wonder if you could talk about that time and how far you think Hollywood has come since then.
Well, you know, I don't really dwell on all of that kind of stuff. I mean, what I do is I take a negative and I make a positive out of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I look for ways to be innovative, bring a whole new perspective. Rather than sit around and argue about one difference as opposed to another difference.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can spend more time being pissed off than necessary.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't like living my life that way.
Yeah.
So I just, if I recognize a discrepancy or a situation that is not agreeable to me, I'll just figure out a way to get through it. You know, I mean, sure you're going to suffer certain frustrations, but that's life.
Yeah. You're a survivor.
I would say so.
Yeah. Around the height of the civil rights movement, you were on Broadway, and I don't know that everyone knows that you've, you know, done Broadway as well. You were starring in A Taste of Honey, and you played a sailor who was involved in an interracial romance, which would have been scandalous at the time.
Oh, that was interesting, right? That period.
Yeah, and you...
It was a curiosity for Americans.
Yeah, yeah. It was a really fascinating role for you. And you also had, around that time, a number of opportunities to become a civil rights activist. But you chose to kind of flex your activist muscles in a different way through your work. Can you talk about that a little bit?
I think there are a lot of different ways to deal with situations.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, I'm basically a loner.
Mm-hmm.
I tried the whole business of joining groups and stuff like that, but it was never agreeable to me. Because I always felt like everybody wanted to be the boss or the chief. And nobody was getting down to business.
Yeah.
So I figured, why don't I do it? I'll just do what I do. And see, and hopefully I will be an example, you know, if I succeed. And that's pretty much I'm not really into the activist thing. I mean, mm-hmm. not that I don't disagree with it. Mm-hmm. I don't, you know, but that's just not who I am.
Yeah. Well, we can't talk about your work without talking about Brian's song, which aired in 1970, 55 million viewers at the time, biggest audience for a TV movie at that time. And of course, when you landed that role and you played Gail Sayers and you were opposite Jimmy Kahn as Brian Piccolo, that also came at a challenging time in your life because there was this parallel where as you're shooting this movie about Brian Piccolo and his battle with cancer, your own dad was being treated for leukemia at that time.
Leukemia.
Yeah. And I wonder if you would talk about the impact of that movie, and maybe if you think it still speaks to us today, especially at a time when issues of race are back on the forefront in America. The whole movie was about an interracial friendship. Can you talk about the impact of that and how maybe it's still speaking to us?
Well, I remember running into a bigot in Georgia. Mm-hmm. Who had to tell me, express to me, the impact it had on his life. And I said, mm-hmm. wow, isn't that interesting? It took a moment out of his life where he didn't have to hate somebody.
Oh, wow.
You know? And I don't know if he went back to hating people again, probably did. But at least he had that one little moment.
Yeah, yeah.
I find all that stuff pretty amusing.
Yeah. Well, and I think it also speaks to your work being a form of activism, like reaching people, not marching or protesting, but doing what you do best, and that has an impact on people.
I'm not that serious. you're talking of, I'm a silly boy.
Mm.
You know. I'm a walking absurdity. I don't take myself that seriously. I take my work seriously.
Yeah.
But I don't take myself seriously.
Yeah.
Not as seriously as you're taking me.
Hey, I'm just going by what you said in the book. It's all there in the book. Okay. I'm just saying.
It's lies, well, I tell you. Lies.
It makes for a good book, though.
No, for a good book, yes.
Well, speaking of serious people, we have to talk about your friend James Baldwin, because you do talk about him at some length in the book, and you talk about how he wanted you to play Malcolm X in a script that he was writing.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about your friendship with him and whatever happened with that movie.
Well, he wanted me to play Malcolm. He saw me in a play on Broadway with Leslie Uggams. Mm-hmm. In a musical, and that's how we met. And but he was writing Malcolm's life for Columbia Pictures, and he wanted me to play it. But they wanted James Earl to play Malcolm,
mm-hmm.
but he wanted to talk about Malcolm's life at a very much earlier point. Mm-hmm. And Jimmy was he was much more mature. Looking and certainly had that big voice.
Mm-hmm.
So he what he was putting together did not work for what he wanted to express about Malcolm.
Yeah.
I mean, Columbia at that time even were talking about Brando playing Malcolm, which I thought, oh, that's interesting. I said, whoa. Okay.
Having a hard time picturing that, actually.
Listen, you know, I'm from that world where, you know, if you think you can do it, go for it.
Speaking of silliness.
But Jimmy was a wonderful man. He was.
Yeah.
He was gay, but he was more man than most men I've met.
Yeah.
And
And you spent time with him in Europe, right? At some point?
Yeah, we talked about, you know, when he called himself an ugly little black faggot, it was something. It was like being, when he talks about being despised.
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever heard anybody talk about being despised the way he talked about being despised. It made you shudder.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Yeah. He was a really dear friend, and you spent time even in Europe
with
him.
Yeah, we went to Europe together and everything. Me, him, and his brother, lover. Yeah, we had a good time.
Yeah. Getting back to the silliness thing, you do tell the story about being fired from a show. You mentioned Leslie Uggams a moment ago. Can you tell us what happened there?
Well, she used to mess with me on the stage and whisper stuff to me. So I decided to whisper something else back to her. And she said, I'm going to tell my husband. Right in the middle of a performance, she said, I'm going to tell my husband.
I'm not married.
Take that, Leslie.
But anyway, I got fired as a result of it. Yeah.
Wasn't there something about a packet of sugar?
Package of sugar.
Like a packet of sugar and landing in someone's...
Oh, no, that was in the Jean Genet's The Blacks. I was a naughty little boy.
How naughty were you, exactly?
Huh? I was in my 20s. But I was I was a spoiled brat, really. The young woman who was playing one of the characters in The Blacks, the character was Snow. And one afternoon, during her matinee, it was the matinee performance, but she had her hair done. Mm-hmm. And I had gone to lunch and got a little package of sugar and poured it in her hair. And she was so upset and so livid. Her mouth was moving, but there was nothing was coming out of her mouth. I thought that was really interesting. But anyway,
she didn't like that.
Anyway, Maya Angelou, who was in the play, they tried to get me fired.
Mm.
No, but... it didn't work.
Well, I mentioned that you starred in Broadway in A Taste of Honey, among other shows, but your Broadway career began at the tender age of 7.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us about that and how you ended up on Broadway at age 7?
Well, my mommy was an aspiring actress and she studied opera for many years. She was working downtown at the Lyceum Theater in New York for Ben Boyer and Max Gordon, who were producers and managers, theater managers. And they were doing a Kurt Weill musical. Kurt Weill was, he wrote with Bertolt Brecht, Three Penny Opera, and his wife, Lotte Lenya, was playing one of the leading characters in the play, and they needed a little boy to play a page boy. So they found out that mommy had a little boy, a cute little boy. And they asked me to come audition. And I went and auditioned. They had me walk across stage one time, walk across stage two times. And they said, Billy, that's thank you very much, that's enough. Well, I decided I wanted to do it the third time. And they insisted that I shouldn't. So I started crying. And I always say, I always say I cried my way into show business. But anyway, that's how I got my first job.
It worked. It was The Firebrand of Florence.
The Firebrand of Florence. It was based on the life of a Renaissance sculptor by the name of Benvenuto Cellini. In fact, there was an opera written about him by one of the great composers from Europe. I forget his name. But anyway, who became enamored with Cellini. He was sort of a swashbuckling character, like Dumas. Those kind of guys. They were like artists, but they were all out there out doing fencing and fighting and getting into all kinds of mischief.
Yeah.
You know, Dumas was like that. Who was the other Alexander in Russia? What was his name? Anybody know? Oh, okay.
We'll think of it. Somebody will think of it. Say it again. Romanov?
Not Romanov. No, I don't think of it.
Yeah. We'll figure it out. Somebody will remember it at 2 o'clock in the morning, right? Pushkin. Pushkin. There it is.
Alexander Pushkin. He was another one. Crazy guy.
Well, speaking of artists, I don't know if everyone knows that you are a very accomplished painter. You studied art as a young person. In fact, you studied at the National Academy of Design in New York.
Design and fine arts, yeah.
Yeah. Can you tell us what is it about painting? What does it mean to you? And tell us a little bit about the kinds of subjects that you like to create on canvas.
Yeah, I could create everything, you know, whatever intrigues me and whatever I'm interested in. Mm-hmm. Painting has been very much a part of my life, all of my life. In New York City, my sister and I went to Music and Art High School. And when we graduated, she went off to NYU, and I went off to the Academy, spent 2 years at the Academy painting. I was nominated for a Guggenheim when I was 18, 19 years old. And I won a Hallgarten, which is comparable to a Guggenheim. In fact, when I kind of started getting interested in acting at that time, and my director, George Porter, found out that I was interested in acting, and he called my mother up and said, "Don't let that boy be an actor, he's a painter." People ask me about that. I mean, the difference between being a painter and being an actor. I think it all contributes to each other. You know, I mean, certainly if you're an actor, you really, it's all about shading. It's all about nuance. It's not just one thing or the other. I mean, it's all these wonderful, interesting gray areas that you play on. And certainly as a painter, you're playing in a lot of gray areas, you know.
Yeah, you're right about how we're all trying to find the light in the darkness.
Yeah, I'm always looking. I'm always coming out of the darkness looking for the light.
Yeah. You talk at length about your family, about growing up in Harlem in the 40s and 50s, and how close-knit all of you were. You mentioned your sister a minute ago, who is your twin.
My twin.
Right?
Yeah.
Was your twin.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about your family and how they influenced you to become the person that you are?
Well, I come from a working-class family, which I'm very proud of. My father worked 3 jobs most of his life. But he always devoted one day a week, and that's usually a Sunday, to the family. We'd go on picnics and go to the beach, and we just had a lot of activity. Had a lot of activities together. We were very close. My father was a wonderful man. I learned a lot from my father. I took on a couple of his jobs one time. one summer when he went out. He bought himself a brand new Buick Special. I think they only cost $6,000 in those days.
But that was a lot of money back then.
Yeah.
Right?
But he drove it all the way down to Texas. He hadn't seen his mother in 20 years. So he drove it all the way to Texas. He and my sister went, and I stayed back and took on a couple of his jobs. And it was probably one of the greatest things that ever happened to me, because I really saw and understood his plight, you know, and what he had to go through in order to take care of his family. Yeah. He was a good man. He was a beautiful, wonderful man.
Yeah.
People liked him because he was never pretentious, never put on airs. Mm-hmm. And we hung out with all the black bourgeoisie at that time, my sister and I, you know, the Jack and Jill and all that sort of stuff. Which I always was amused by, anyway.
Yeah.
But it was an interesting experience.
Yeah. In the book, you talk about how the one role that you wanted to play but did not get to play, at least not thus far, is Duke Ellington, and that you came close to it a time or two. What was it about Duke Ellington that attracted you to him as a person, that made you want to play him?
Well, I understood his sensibility. I mean, I grew up around that kind of sensibility.
Yeah.
But I met him. A very good friend of mine was the managing editor for the New York Age up 135th Street in Harlem. And he had a reception for Ellington one time. And the room was filled with all of these ladies, and I'm waiting for Ellington to come. And he was very charming. Mm-hmm. And I remember he made each woman feel like she was the only woman in that room. I took out my pen and pad.
So that's where you learned it from.
Okay. But you know, he used to compete with his father to see who was most charming.
Wow.
But he was a wonderful character. I met him years later again. But I always wanted to, I always felt like the only one who could really pull it off is me. Because you know, I understand that kind of, you know. Well, I don't know what I'm looking for the right word.
That kind of suave, charming.
Yeah, I understand all that stuff.
Somebody said facts. You know, I don't know that everyone in our audience knows this about you, but that you also are a singer. In fact, you did an impromptu performance at a jazz club one night and ended up with a recording contract, and you made an album.
Well, you know the song A Taste of Honey?
Mm-hmm.
That was written. I was the first to ever sing that song on stage with Joan Plowright, Joni Plowright, Olivier's wife. Mm-hmm. This president of Prestige Label was started a new label called Lively Arts, and Hermione Baddeley was signed, and he signed Malcolm McDowell, like a movie star at that time. But anyway, He liked what I was doing, so he asked me if I wanted to sign a contract to do an album. I said, sure, why not? You know, and I had been studying singing, and also I had my two friends, George Corey and Douglas Cross, who they wrote "I Left My Heart in San Francisco." They were training me to be what in those days. Mm-hmm. Was a chic nightclub singer, like a chanteur, what they call a chanteur, mm-hmm. or a chanteuse is a woman. Mm-hmm. So, like, I don't know if you've ever heard of Mabel Mercer.
Mm.
Oh, and Mabel Mercer was amazing. Mm. In fact, Sinatra loved her. Mm. But anyway. Yeah, I went and did this album. I was living with a woman at that time who was one of the biggest madams in New York City. And that was an interesting life.
Oh, there's a story there.
But my whole life has been really like an adventure. You know, I was always a nice kid, you know, but always kind of like getting into situations because I was really interested in finding out what was going on.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if J.D. Salinger wrote a book called Catcher in the Rye. And I always sort of related to that character, you know, this little boy that runs around getting himself into situations that maybe he shouldn't get into.
Yeah.
But it was all an adventure for me.
Yeah, yeah.
But anyway, I ended up doing this record called Let's Misbehave with Billy Dee Williams.
Somehow that title doesn't come as a surprise. And by the way, that album, if you all have Spotify, that album is there. You can listen to it even now on the way home tonight. You can listen to A Taste of Honey.
I don't know if they want to listen.
Oh, I think they do.
I mean, there are a couple of songs that were pretty good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, more than a couple.
But
I
ended up, you know, singing in nightclubs, you know, just to see whether I could do it or not.
Yeah.
I went off to the Playboy Club back in Chicago, sang there for a few weeks.
Okay.
That's when I first heard Malcolm X.
Mm.
And he really impressed the hell out of me.
Yeah.
In fact, I almost missed the performance because he was on television talking, expressing himself.
Yeah.
And he was expressing himself in a way that I had never heard a black man express himself. Mm. With so much authority, but it was interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so you've done Broadway, television, movies, obviously. You are an accomplished painter. And along the way, while you were doing all of those things, you managed to have 3 weddings and 2 children who have played a huge role in your life. Can you share a little bit with us? I mean, your children are obviously grown now, but can you share a little bit about your kids?
Well, my first wife, Hurricane Audrey. she was something else. You know, that kind of woman will call you all kinds of MFs and dare you to say something back.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was Audrey. But she was a wonderful woman. And that's my son's mother.
Mm-hmm. And that would be Corey.
Corey. And Corey is like my best friend.
Yeah.
In fact, before he was born, I knew he was. I kept saying, my best friend is coming. And he showed up. And I missed his birth by one day because I was on the road with A Taste of Honey.
Mm.
And when I got back home, I just couldn't take my eyes off of him.
Yeah.
I was just a kid myself, you know, 22 years old, 23 years old.
Mm-hmm.
But he and I have always been very, very, very close. But then when I had my daughter from my third marriage, my second marriage, there were no children because she wanted to be a big-time actress.
Uh-huh.
Well, she just passed away just recently, as a matter of fact.
Mm.
But she was a beauty, Marlene.
Mm-hmm.
But she changed her name to Marlena, and I refused to call her Marlena. But she was quite a beauty. And did some movies, did a few movies.
Mm-hmm.
But my third marriage, I married a Japanese woman, Teruko. And had this beautiful daughter, Hanako, whom I just love her to death.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but you know, it's all been a charming life. It's fun.
Yeah. I should say so. Well, on that note, why don't we open it up for your questions for Billy D. Williams?
All right, cheers, folks.
Good evening. It's such an honor to be here and to meet you. I mean, I've been excited about every movie you've played in. But I would ask, and I know this is a question that you've been asked millions of times, what was your favorite role to play?
My favorite role?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Out of all the movies.
Let's see, my favorite role. I don't know, I had a few. It was one character I played. I did a movie in Toronto and up in Canada called Giant Steps. It was Coltrane's Giant Steps. But I played this jazz musician. I loved that character to the point where I didn't want to stop being that character. Slate Thompson. Hey, yeah. I loved that character. Arvo. Hello, Arvo. By the way, you know, I end my book with a quote from a great jazz musician, Lester Young, who was one of the great saxophonists. Pork pie hat. I end the book with the word chandelier. You know, when somebody asks you, how you feeling today? And rather than get into a whole long discussion, chandelier. I forget the question you asked. I got off into this.
I think you answered it about your favorite role. That was the question.
You know, I play, you know, certainly, playing in Lady Sings the Blues, that character. When I saw myself walking down the stairs in that white suit, I thought, oh my goodness.
We thought that too, didn't we?
I said, I'm in love.
We have a question over here. Yes.
I'm just joking, by the way.
I'm one of your biggest fans. Ooh, I love you in Bingo Long and Nighthawks.
That was one of my favorite characters.
Yes. I love you. I'm one of your biggest fans. I got all your movies. And I'm one of all your big... you know who you are? I can't stop seeing you in all your movies you used to play and everything. I love you. I can't stop thinking about you. I'm crazy about you.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. Appreciate that.
She is all of us, right? Yes.
Honored to meet you, sir. First of all, I just had to mention that for a whole generation of guys, Brian's song is probably the first movie that made us cry. Okay? And the other thing was the Bingo Long, Traveling All-Stars, and Motor Kings, one of my favorite movies from the 70s. Hell of a cast, you, James Earl Jones, Richard Pryor, and everyone has just gone on to do so many great things since it, but there's not a lot of background information out about that film. You can't find any online. I'm hoping there's some info in the book. I was always curious, as it was filmed in the South, down in Georgia, did the cast ever have any problems with any of the locals?
No, we didn't have any problems, really, that I can remember, to tell you the truth. No, we were pretty well received down there. I had a lot of fun doing that movie. Yeah. Especially working with, and I remember when I was a kid growing up in New York, my father and I used to go to Central Park and watch the Cuban ball players and a lot of the black ball players of the Negro leagues during that period. So when I worked with those guys, I mean, they were amazing. It was an education. I mean, there was no CGI in those days.
Right.
I mean, then when they did stuff that it was like for real, you know, it was fascinating. But we didn't, as I recall, we didn't have a lot of, and I took Corey with me, and he had a good time making friends with all of the races. You know? They were inviting him to their house. No,
more questions for Billy Dee Williams. Yes, there's a lady kind of in the center here. Yes, with the scarf.
Hello, sir. How are you? It's very nice to see you tonight. Do you have a dollar to give me?
What was that?
Do you have a dollar to give me?
A dollar?
A dollar. Think about it.
I gave you a dollar?
Can you give me a dollar?
Why did I give you a dollar?
That way I can, like, stand there and let your arm, you know, hang, and then you can say that line to me.
It's a Lady Sings the Blues reference, I think, right?
I'll take that. Thank you. In all seriousness, thank you. I love you.
Thank you very much.
Yes.
Okay, one more question. Go ahead.
Did you ever meet Ethel Waters? Did you ever work with her?
Yeah, I met her.
Yeah, that's my great aunt. I just wanted to, you know. Nice to meet you.
She was rough.
Hey, I know. Thank you, love. I love you. Thank you.
Yes.
She was a great actress, though. She was great. Great singer.
I'm Valicia Selby, and I was barely born when you did the movie Mahogany. It's my favorite movie. So I want to ask a question, and I have a request. The chemistry was so strong between you and Diana Ross. Was there ever anything off screen?
No, we never had anything off screen, though.
Okay.
And if we did, I wouldn't tell you.
Okay. So I wanted to tell you that every man that I've dated, they know that Mahogany is my favorite movie.
I thought it was a good movie.
It was a very good movie. And my favorite line was when you said, "Success is nothing unless you have someone to share it with." Can you say that for me?
Success is nothing without someone to share it with. But I mean, that was an old... Barry Gordy, that was one of the things that he created. He was good at that kind of stuff. But that's an old adage, that expression.
Thank you.
But there was something about the way you said it. Right?
It's nothing. Success is nothing. I don't know. I can't say it now. I don't know. That was a long time ago.
50 years ago, you did a play here. I have a dream, and I kept this in my high school keepsake. You signed it for me.
Oh, wow.
And I just wanted to share this with you. You were a wonderful inspiration to the English class that went to visit you from high school, Roxborough High School.
Wow.
Come on. Yeah, playing Dr. King was a real interesting experience for me.
Mr. Williams, I'm from that generation back in the 60s and 70s where everybody wanted to be Billy Dee. And not only the look, but the voice. The voice was all iconic, and we used it whenever we could. And it worked sometimes. Were you aware of how much of an effect you had on people during those times, especially young men?
Yeah, I guess, you know, at some point, yeah, but I don't take myself seriously. You know, but, yeah, how can you not be aware? I mean, everybody was, like, telling you every single day of your life. You know, how wonderful you are. You know. So, I mean, but I don't let any of that stuff.
Hey, it helped us out.
Listen, I used to have to go, I had more guys who wanted to hang out with me because they knew there would be a lot of ladies around.
Mr. Williams, I just wanted to say thank you for taking the time to come here and share your life with us. And that's all. You're a blessing.
You're very sweet. Thank you.
If you had to give yourself advice from your 20-year-old self, what would it be?
Well, I always say I don't like to give advice, and I don't, actually. I don't know. I really don't know. Tell you the truth, I really don't know.
Chandelier.
I think that, you know, chandelier.
I just wanted to say thank you for my childhood, and just wondering if you had any Richard Pryor stories or experiences from, I think you did at least 3 movies together, I think.
Well, I don't want to talk about it.
There's some stuff in the book, though. He's in the book, right?
Mr. Williams, if I was a genie and you had one wish, what would it be?
I don't know. Chandelier, baby.
Ladies and gentlemen, I know we have many more questions. I'm sorry that we couldn't get to all of them. You all have been so gracious and patient. But we need to let Mr. Williams get on his way. He's still got several more stops on his tour and many more audiences to talk to. But please join me in thanking him for a wonderful evening.
May the force be with you. Stay well, everybody.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.